Case number 215706, Johnny Sims Madison versus Dana Commercial Vehicle Manufacturing et al. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Biesecker for the appellant.
May it please the court, my name is Kyle Biesecker with the law firm Biesecker, DeCanich & Macer. I represent the appellant, Johnny Sims Madison, in this matter, and I've reserved 3 minutes of rebuttal time.
Thank you.
As a quick introduction, Ms. Sims Madison is African-American, and she was 66 years old at the time, or the relevant time frame during this matter. She alleged under the Kentucky Civil Rights Act that she was terminated discriminatorily based on her race and age from her employment with Dana Corporation. The district court granted Dana's motion for summary judgment on both counts. There are three issues on appeal before the court today. The first issue was she replaced and by whom, or were her job duties simply absorbed by all the current employees at Dana Corporation? Secondly, whether or not the people that she identified are in fact similarly situated as required under the McDonnell-Douglas test for comparative analysis. And third, did Ms. Sims Madison provide sufficient evidence of pretext regarding Dana's proffered legitimate non-discriminatory reason for her termination of an appointment from Dana Corporation? Issue one was whether
she... What's your best evidence of pretext? Just cut to the chase.
Read your brief.
Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor. Her best evidence of pretext, and that's one of the main issues. We believe the district court erred in too stringently applied Chin, the ruling in Chin versus Dow Chemical Corporation.
Well, what's your, I know the case law. What's your best evidence? Sorry if I wasn't clear.
One is she should have never been on final warning in the first place. She was placed on final warning, and that was one of the main reasons, the justifications given by Dana for her termination of employment.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but whether she should have been on final warning goes to a provision of the collective bargaining agreement, right? So it's whether the company followed internal policies and procedures. And we've said that's generally not enough to show pretext. It might be some other kind of claim, like they failed to follow their internal policies. Maybe you have grievance with the union, although those claims were dismissed by the district court. So how does that show the fact that, let's say she shouldn't have been on final warning, that you're right about that, how does that show race or age discrimination?
Well, I believe that's what we're arguing in our brief, Your Honor, that there's five or six things that should have been taken in totality in complete context. Maybe all six of the things we're going to point to in and of themselves are not individually enough to establish pretext. But we believe the district court analyzed each one of those in a vacuum instead of as a totality, as Chin requires. I talk about it's important to avoid formalization and application of the three requirements of pretext, and that it needs to be, we need to be careful because we want to avoid losing the forest from the trees.
So I understand that, but the reason that the employer gave is, well, she had bad conduct, she wasn't respectful with her peers. There's no question they wanted to fire her. I mean, that's very well established. And the question is for an okay reason or an impermissible reason. So maybe they skipped the procedural steps, just as you allege. They didn't follow the collective bargaining agreement provision that has this like 12-month look-back period. But how does that show age or race motivation as opposed to we're skipping procedural steps because of her conduct is so bad we want to get rid of her? Now, I'm not saying that's good behavior. It's just not necessarily actionable under the KCRA. It would be a violation of the collective bargaining agreement.
But I believe when an employer skips those steps and intentionally skips those steps to put someone on final warning to give themselves justification,
mm-hmm.
they've made the decision, the bad actor in this matter being the head of human resources, Mr. Greenham, or alleged bad actor, skip those steps intentionally to get to our client to a final, Ms. Sims Madison, to a final warning, so thereby he could justify her termination when it would have been more difficult for him to do so without skipping those policies and procedures. I believe that's the evidence pretext. Had she been white or had she been under the age of 40, he wouldn't have skipped those steps. And we believe the similarly situated folks, those steps didn't get skipped.
Did he skip them? I don't know the answer to this. Did he skip them with Carla Piper?
Pardon me?
With Carla Piper, did he skip them?
I don't believe he did. I believe she was put on final warning with the 5-day suspension. I don't believe Dana skipped those steps necessary. And followed the policy procedure when it came to her termination.
Can they, like Judge Larson was saying, I get that there's a collective bargaining agreement, and I get they may have violated it by skipping the steps. But if someone's particularly egregious, can't they fire them? I mean, if someone goes out and robs a bank and comes to, do you have to go through all the procedures? You might violate the collective bargaining agreement, but it surely seems like a company could fire them, right?
I agree, Your Honor. I mean, there's certain...
So if they're causing a terrible environment... as they thought Sims Madison was, isn't that a justification to fire her?
As long as you fire everyone, equally, that's engaging in the same conduct. And, part of our argument is there's similarly situated folks outside of her protected class that create a bad environment arguing user.
The district court went through each of the comparators and distinguished them, correct?
That's correct.
And the only one that was similarly situated, as I understand it, was Carla Piper, who was also fired.
Right, and we disagree with the court's assessment and a district court's assessment. That's part of the issue we're appealing, that how they concluded that the other individuals were not similarly situated to Ms. Sims Madison.
But weren't all the other individuals, they had isolated incidents of bad conduct, and it's really only Ms. Piper and Ms. Sims Madison, who are kind of repeated violators of company norms, and they were both on final warning, and they both got dismissed.
That's correct, Your Honor. Yes, the other folks that we have pointed to in the record in the brief, similarly situated, do not appear to have as many instances as Ms. Sims Madison did. But again, that turns back to the fact that those past instances should not have been held against Ms. Sims Madison in the first place, and she shouldn't have been on final.
But then they're not similarly situated, right? If one's got one incident and one's got five, you can't say they're similarly situated. We agree on that. So then the district court didn't err in saying they weren't good comparators. Fair or not unfair?
I believe that's fair, Your Honor.
Okay.
But your argument is that with respect to all the rest of them, they followed the procedures.
I believe the procedure was followed with the rest of the similarly situated individuals, not with our client.
Did you really brief that argument? I mean, you do say they, Ms. Sims Madison should not have been on final warning because it violated the CBA to put her on final warning because it should have been wiped out after 12 months. But I didn't see in there where you say the other comparators, the other alleged comparators, or it's really only Carla Piper who's on final warning, that they followed the rules with respect to her. I just didn't see that piece in your argument.
Well, I believe with a lot of the, several of the similarly situated comparators, Mr. Greenham, again, alleged bad actor in this matter, was aware of this conduct, engaged in this conduct himself, and they simply weren't disciplined in any way, shape, or form. No action was taken against those similarly situated folks at all, as compared to Sims Madison, who anytime anyone raised any issue, she was called in, as we briefed, that she was called in, immediately put under the microscope, and she testified her disciplinary action was already written up, ready for her to sign by Mr. Greenham, as opposed to hearing her side of the story. We are arguing that the fact that they ignored Dana Corpin, specifically Mr. Greenham, ignored other individuals' conduct outside of Ms. Sims Madison's protected class, weren't disciplined in any way, shape, or form as being relevant. I guess turning back to the replacement issue, you know, Ms. Sims Madison testified under oath at her deposition that she was replaced by Steve Leachman, a white man who was at the time age 55 years old, 11 years old, younger than Ms. Sims Madison, which I understand above the age of 40, but still 11 years her junior. She knew his name, his age, his race, his years of service with the company, how he got her job, she bid on it, etc. However, the district court dismissed her sworn testimony as conclusory, while Dana, to dispute her testimony, submitted a declaration for Mr. Greenham, which we argue is the same at a minimum as conclusory in itself. He did not point to any facts. There's no documents. There's no other evidence that they provided that supports Mr. Greenham's declaration. In the court, even though there's a material fact in dispute, and we believe a very important fact in dispute, the court made the assessment, I believe, that Greenham and Dana was telling the truth and my client was not, or they're accurate and she's not.
So what your opponent would say about that is, well, Mr. Greenham was the HR manager, so he was in a position to know, whereas your client wasn't in a position to know. I guess one question I have about that is that the right kind of determination for a court to make, or is it more a question for a jury to say, well, who has a greater foundation, font of knowledge, so who's more credible? I mean, I guess.
Well, I don't think the position Mr. Greenham held necessarily makes him more credible. I mean, they didn't support, Dana didn't provide anything other than this his Mr. Greenham's declaration that all of her job duties were absorbed by other employees. I mean, as a plaintiff,
and so your position is that is a question for the
jury? Yeah, it's a question for the jury. How do we disprove? I mean, it'd be impossible for almost a plaintiff to I don't know how you go about disproving some declaration like that. And I think the jury should determine who is more credible in their both sworn testimony. It was a credibility determination. And so we believe that the district court on that issue, drew an inference in favor of the non-movement Dana Corp in violation of Tolan v. Cotton. With regard to similarly situated, I believe we covered most of that, Your Honor. We believe that, I'm out of time, Your Honor.
You're not quite out of time.
Pardon me?
Now you're.
Sorry.
May it please the court. My name is Brian Dershaw, and I represent Dana Commercial Vehicle Manufacturing. In this appeal brought by Johnny Sims Madison, I want to address some of the issues that the court addressed with appellant's counsel. On pretext, the question becomes whether or not this individual presented sufficient evidence to demonstrate that the final warning and the violation of that and the reasoning for that termination had no basis in fact. Appellant Johnny Sims Madison did not present any sufficient evidence that Dana had no basis in fact for its decision. There was a final warning. She violated it. She was terminated. Next, appellant did not present any sufficient evidence that this did not actually motivate the termination. There's nothing to suggest. Ms. Sims Madison understands.
What about the fact that they're supposed to wipe the record clean every 12 months? How should we factor that into our analysis?
Really, there should be no factor at first, but I'll go into other reasons. The Labor Management Relations Act would preempt that.
Yeah, but you didn't raise that claim. I mean, you might be right about that, that the union got its claims dismissed under the LMRA. It seems like a complicated question. But you didn't raise that in the district court. You, despite the fact that the union raised an LMRA preemption defense, so presumably it was triggered in your mind, you didn't argue that in front of the district court.
As it would relate to the district court, the argument at that time is, was she discriminated against in the basis of her termination?
So the answer to Judge Larson's question is yes, just so I'm clear.
Well, I would say yes, we didn't need to argue that there. It was raised here on the appeal that they had to go to the collective bargaining agreement to determine whether or not the company properly followed the process. The other claims had been just simple discrimination.
I see. So I'm sorry. So your argument is that Ms. Sims Madison didn't argue in the district court that she should not have been on the 12-month look back because of the CBA, and therefore you didn't have a reason to raise your LMRA defense?
It didn't need to be addressed at that point, correct?
Well, wait,
but why?
Or didn't she?
Well, no, she, sorry. So Ms. Sims Madison's argument on that, the arguments that we raised at the district court was, even if you look at the collective bargaining agreement, which courts aren't going to look at to make any interpretation, on the 12-month look back, that doesn't take away the type of discipline that a company can impose and that Dana could impose. It says specifically in the collective bargaining agreement, it has the discretion to impose the discipline based upon the
I'm still trying to figure out the answer to Judge Larson's question. Did she argue below that you had an obligation to wipe her slate clean?
She has argued that the company failed to follow the procedures. I would not say she argued they had an obligation to wipe her slate clean, because there is no such obligation when it comes to the collective bargaining agreement.
Okay, and so you're saying she's raising a new argument on appeal?
That is, we did indicate that there are new arguments she raised on appeal. Yes. Oh.
Wait, she argued in the district court that the company failed to follow its procedures. Those procedures come from the collective bargaining agreement.
Well.
Yes?
Yes and no. So if you look at the comparators, I mean, one of the things here is Ms. Sims Madison presents evidence that really has no corroboration or substantiation. They're largely just her conclusions. So her evidence, as it related to that, went to the similarly situated employees. And she brought people in who were outside of the bargaining unit, who were in management, and who didn't follow under that same collective bargaining agreement. So if it weren't raised, we would still argue the fact that if the company did not follow those procedures, that still doesn't lead to pretext. Because within that, they do have the discretion to identify what the appropriate discipline is. And if you look at the collective bargaining agreement, which we would think the court need not, you can see that when Johnny Sims Madison was placed on her final warning, which was a reduction and a compromise, that she was on a 5-day suspension with intent to terminate, that went to a 1-day suspension with the final warning. When she was placed on that, she never grieved it. Her union never grieved it. So if we're going to dig into the collective bargaining agreement, you would see that became a final entry, not appealable at that point from her. She knows she's got a final warning. She knows if she violates it, she's going to get terminated. She violated it in January and February of 2019.
But even when it was imposed, your client questioned it. There was a letter, arguably she shouldn't be on a final warning.
And again, that's arguably. The client may have placed that, in the record to understand. However, based upon the circumstances, the company determined that that was the proper discipline to impose. But then working with the union and Ms. Sims Madison, they reduced that discipline from the 5-day with intent to terminate to 1-day suspension with a final warning, again, that Ms. Sims Madison agreed to, that the union agreed to, and that nobody ever grieved.
Yeah, but okay, but what that sounds to me like is you're trying to raise an exhaustion argument. Like, she has to exhaust her union grievance remedies before she can state a claim under the Kentucky Civil Rights Act. And there are all kinds of exhaustion claims in the law, but I just didn't see one in the KCRA. Now, that might be because the claim is actually LMRA preempted, but again, I don't know that you raised the LMRA preemption claim until you got here. And even there, you give us like 2 sentences.
No, and really in this case, I mean, to answer the question, it's not there. As for the exhaustion, it's more a response to what she's arguing as it relates to the policy. But the case largely comes down to what standard does a non-movement have in presenting evidence to raise a genuine issue of material fact. And each of their 3 arguments, when you look at the argument as to was she replaced, what evidence did Ms. Sims Madison provide to the court that she was replaced by a 55-year-old white male? She provided to the court her assertion. She believed she was replaced. She even indicated she believes that person bid on the job, which case law would indicate that means there's no discriminatory animus. That's just part of the normal collective bargaining process and the agreement that somebody bids on a job, they're the next person up.
I think the testimony, I don't have it in front of me, but I thought it said he got the bid.
In other words, he testified to that, yes.
Well, right, but like, Is there some reason why we would think she's incompetent to testify to that? Like, she might have friends and associates. She might know who got her job.
Well, I would say there's reason to think she's incompetent. Again, she's just providing the unsubstantiated conclusion that somebody else got the job. The company provided in discovery, and then again with the declaration, as well as in its response to her complaint, that they never filled that position. They distributed the duties. The distinguishment
here... But the affidavit is not particularly detailed. It doesn't... It just says, we didn't fill the job, we distributed her duties. It doesn't say, oh, you know, Mr. Leachman is still doing his same job, and he absorbed some of her duties, and some of her duties went to Ms. Smith, and some of her duties went to Ms. Jones. It seems almost as conclusory as what she says, so why does your client win on that?
Well, I would disagree with this. It's almost as conclusory, because it's really dependent on what is firsthand knowledge versus what is secondhand or unsubstantiated knowledge. Here you've got the company, the human resources manager, who's providing the information as to what happened within the company. You actually can look at the Tolan versus Cotton case and find that this follows it directly. In that case, you had two individuals who were both at the incident of the shooting, the shooter and the person who was shot. One is testifying, hey, it's dimly lit and dark outside. The other was testifying, it's light outside. That's conflicting testimony of people with firsthand knowledge. Here the company's presenting, we did distribute your duties, we did not fill this position. Ms. Sims-Madison says, oh no, you did fill it, but she doesn't provide corroborating testimony. She doesn't offer anything from anyone. If she's saying her friends told her this, it's an admissible hearsay evidence. It's simply her conclusion, where the company who's got the company records knows what it did or didn't do and provides it through their HR manager what it did. Mr. Leachman isn't involved with this case at all, wouldn't know why we would have to put out what he's still doing. He was only raised by Johnny Sims-Madison. And Johnny Sims-Madison made that conclusion, and we still have no idea where she's drawn that conclusion. Similarly, when you look at the comparable individual she believed violated a similar policy. She didn't provide any evidence that they actually violated some policy. She didn't provide any evidence that anybody else was under a final warning. There is evidence in the record that there was one other employee under a final warning.
Yeah, Carla Piper. And the appellant says that with respect to Carla Piper, you followed all the appropriate procedures, but you didn't follow them with respect to her. And because Carla Piper is of a different race and younger, we should infer race discrimination from that. Or at least that's what he's saying now. I'm not sure I said that before, but...
Well, interestingly, Carla Piper is not within the union. So she's not under the same collective bargaining agreement.
So because she was a salaried employee, she's differently situated?
From that alone, she would be different. She could be. Courts would look at that factor as being differently situated.
So you're saying with a salaried employee, you can do 100 different things than you could with a union employee, and they would never be similarly situated.
I wouldn't say that's entirely correct, because there are factors which you would look into court to give the benefit to plaintiffs in this case that you could look into, whether there's a similar supervisor, the exact same policy, or a similar process, and other mitigating. Carla Piper isn't distinguishable, though, just because she's a salaried employee. Or we could say she is similarly situated in the fact of how she was treated. She was treated worse. The actual record evidence before the court was after an incident, she moved to a 3-day suspension, then the final warning and termination, as opposed to the 5-day reduced to a 1-day and then provide 5-day with intent to terminate. So 5-day and she was going to be terminated. That was taken away from Ms. Sims-Madison, reduced to a 1-day and put on a final warning. So in many respects, Ms. Piper was actually treated worse, and she's a younger Caucasian employee. And that's what courts are to look at when you look at the comparable employees and similarly situated. There are distinguishing and mitigating factors. Here the instance, and the big thing, is the disciplinary history and the final warning. The fact is Ms. Sims-Madison was under a final warning. When the lower court looked at that related to the other employees, she declared simply violated the other policy. It noted no evidence was provided that they too were under a final warning. And this logically makes sense. If somebody commits one incident of similar conduct, they're likely not to be terminated. Versus somebody who commits an incident and they're on a final warning, they will be terminated. they're not comparable employees when it comes to that respect. Lastly, and we discussed this a little bit as it relates to the pretext argument. Again, as Ms. Sims-Madison hasn't necessarily challenged whether she committed the conduct or whether that conduct violated the final warning. She points only to whether the company followed its processes and procedures. As this court's noted, you know, companies don't have to leave every stone unturned. Companies don't even have to engage in the most optimal process. I'm not saying that Dana didn't, but it's not that this court is a super personnel department that's going to look and make sure every I was dotted and T was crossed. She presented no sufficient evidence that Dana had no basis in fact for her termination. In fact, I think everybody agrees there were accusations that she had committed the conduct that led to her final warning. She had committed that conduct just 4 to 5 months later, and that led to the termination. She's not offered anything to say that this didn't motivate Dana's reaction. She's indicated that Dana had made comments to her about her retirement, and that that's what motivated, that they were trying to force her retirement. Such inquiries alone are not evidence of pretext or sufficient to overcome summary judgment, but here particularly so. In this case, it's interesting to note, Ms. Sims-Madison denied, really up until close to summary judgment briefing, that she had ever announced her intent to retire. Then in discovery, she disclosed a secret recording she made of the meeting where she was imposed her discipline in September of 2018. And in that meeting, it says, I'm going to retire in January. And so after that, she's indicating these individuals who asked her, hey, when's your retirement date? So that they get appropriate benefits as a union member, things like that. Somehow that's inappropriate. It's not. It's a simple inquiry.
What about the birthday party or the retirement party? Hanging up the banner, hey, Ms. Sims-Madison, this could be you.
Well, I guess in what context? Ask what the question specifically is there.
Isn't that evidence of maybe they were trying to push her out the door?
Not at all. As evidence, well, what that would have related to is, you know, Dana's working with their employee that announced their retirement. Ms. Sims-Madison had been there for many years. You know, she had been through many disciplinary issues, many of these conduct issues. She only got terminated when she violated her final warning. The fact that they're trying to work with her to allow her departure from the company in an appropriate manner, or to show in the ways that they could have that, is not evidence of discrimination on the basis of her age. They simply were willing to work with her as they had the entirety of her career. You know, she was a longstanding employee. You know, she did have a longstanding record of disciplinary issues. But it wasn't until that violation of that final warning that it led to her termination. With each of these in mind, you know, we submit the district court did not err. It was appropriate the way they weighed the evidence under Tolan versus Cotton. They did not improperly look at factors related to similarly situated employees, and Ms. Sims-Madison never showed evidence of pretext to overcome summary judgment. Thank you.
If I may, Your Honor, just very briefly, the issue of Sims-Madison and the policy regarding 12 months disciplinary is supposed to be wiped clean was addressed, briefed, and ruled on at the district court level. In fact, Judge McKinley, on his opinion, at the bottom of page 1, page 2, lists out Article 10 in its entirety because of the importance to the case, I believe. So I do believe that was briefed and addressed appropriately. And then, just to sum up in closing, as Dana touched on there at the end, there was numerous reasons Ms. Sims-Madison gave as evidence or tiles of the mosaic, if you will, evidence of pretext, and we just believe those should be considered as a whole in determining her pretext argument. Thank you.
Other than the fact that they did not follow the procedure.
Yes.
And the questioning about her retirement. Mm-hmm. Do you have anything else that shows that the real reason wasn't her behavior, but rather it was animus regarding her race or age.
Other than what you touched on, Your Honor, the comments and that not shouldn't have been on the final warning and not following the disciplinary policy procedure, we also have pointed to Mr. Greenbaum, the decision maker. Mr. Greenham's, the decision maker, his emails that he sent contemporaneously with terminating our client, and then also the timing of her termination, because as Dana touched on, Ms. Sims Madison testified to, on the recording, give me 5 more months. Well, as soon as that 5 months hit, we believe it's not a coincidence, and she hadn't retired, she was terminated. It's almost 5 months to the day from that initial meeting. But other than that, that's what we have, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. Case will be submitted.